Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Steve Ray was once upon a time an enthusiastic American Baptist, steeped in the Bible and Reformation theology, and a passionate member of his Baptist church, until he began to read Irenaeus of Lyon, Ignatius of Antioch, Clement of Rome, and Polycarp of Smyrna, and was astonished to discover that the sub-apostolic church that Jesus left behind him looked, sounded, felt, read, prayed, and spoke like the Catholic Church. And this began a journey of discovery that led to both him and his wife being received into the church. Steve became one of the most effective Catholic apologists for the faith in our generation. Part of the surprise he springs on his audience is that his character, the timbre of his voice, his reflexes, his enthusiasms are quintessentially those of a passionate Bible-believing Baptist. So there's something of a shock when from his mouth, his head and his heart come one of the most informed and well-tuned presentations of the virtues of Catholicism that you might ever hear. He's the author of some books. They're both erudite and popular, in particular Crossing the Tiber, which is a handbook for the anxious, hesitant Protestant Catholic convert, and Upon This Rock, a magisterial defence of the Petrine Office. Following the recent deaths of Pope Emeritus Benedict and the redoubtable and beloved Cardinal Pell, shadowed by scandals, sexual and financial, there is a sense that the Church has come to another critical juncture in her journey. I asked Steve Ray to offer his reflections on his conversion to Catholicism, his passion for the Catholic Church, and his take on the future. And he joins me now.
Steve, thank you very much for joining me today. It's such a pleasure to meet you. I have been an avid fan of your books and most of your YouTube videos, so occasionally a new one pops up, as it has done today, but we'll talk about that later. Thank you for joining us on the Catholic Herald podcast. Tell me a bit about your work. You've been an assiduous, enthusiastic convert, one I entirely identify with, and you go around the world telling Protestants the Reformation was a mistake and they've got it wrong. How do you do it?
Well, first I call it the deformation. I won't call it the Reformation. But thank you for having me on, Gavin. I've heard about you and looked forward to this time where I could meet you and talk. And so just so the listeners know, we're meeting each other for the first time, and I'm very thrilled to with somebody with your experience and your background and your degrees in education. And I find you to be delightful. You remind me of a little boy who has just discovered this new toy that he's never seen before, and he just can't get enough of it.
Oh, but that's so true. Yes, that's it.
And I say that with complete, not belittling, but as a, I can't say it anything more honorable about you than that, because you still have your insatiable curiosity to learn and to discover, and you've discovered the world's best kept secret. And I've been a convert now for 28 years, but I have to say that I still wake up in the morning excited about it. I still can't believe I'm a Catholic, and I do love what we do. My wife and I came across the Tiber River together. We've been married 46 years. We have 4 kids and 19 grandchildren. And they're all thoroughly Catholic. It was our family culture that we had. Everything was about being Catholic and Christian. It wasn't about my job or about sports. Anybody that would say, what do you say about the Ray family? They say they are thoroughly Christian, and that's what they do. That's who they are. Our kids picked up on it, and I'm very pleased with that. But I have written books and made documentary movies in 16 countries following the story of salvation history, and I lead pilgrimages, 100 already, to Israel. And overall, we're just still overwhelmed and enjoying being Catholic.
I don't want to be spiritually pretentious, but there is something about the story of the prodigal son here. I often think cradle Catholics don't realize what it's like to have left home and to have tried to do this whole religious thing in a system that doesn't work and doesn't, you know, and only when you're sort of eating the Zwinglian husks of cardboard bread, which is not the Mass, do you come running back to have a feast at the Father's house. And so the elder brothers look at us and say, well, why are you so excited about the banquet and the feast and being home? And the answer is because we've been away and we've tried it differently and it doesn't work, and it is magnificent to be home.
It is.
And so I realize they find this a bit over ebullient, but it is the truth, and it's an experience that many of us share.
Very much so. I can relate to it, and I know a lot of converts over here that are the same way. They get so enthusiastic that they almost turn people off at first because they come flying right in their face and they want to tell them everything right now and why they're wrong and why I'm right and we discovered this. And people get taken aback by all that. But there's a lot of enthusiasm when you discover the best kept secret in the world.
That's absolutely true. I'd just like to ask you a bit about your work, because not everyone will have been following you, and this will be a discovery for some, a delightful one. So you do two things. I mean, I often describe my journey into the Catholic Church like a trapeze artist. I was on a trapeze up there, and the trapeze I was on began to give way. And I was extremely grateful to find another trapeze coming towards me, the Catholic Church, which I could get hold of. But there were two elements to this. One was, you know, my trapeze was failing. And I hoped very much this other trapeze wouldn't fail. And so it doesn't. It's the true church. It's the church the gates of hell will not prevail against. I often feel a bit guilty looking back over my shoulder and saying to people, you know, Anglicanism is defective. It can't work. It won't do the things you want it to do. In case they think it's sour grapes or I'm somehow being superior and asking people to be like me because I'm me, rather than to be like me because it's the church that Jesus founded. How do you manage this dual thing of bigging up the Catholic Church? Well, of course, that's easy. But at the same time, being pretty robustly critical of the deformation churches.
Yeah, I like deformation because I will not call it the Reformation. People call with Martin Luther the Reformation and under King Henry VIII the Reformation. But I can't do that. I call it the deformation because what it did is caused a huge split in the church. We over here say, united we stand, divided we fall. Jesus prayed that all of us would be perfected in unity so that the world may know the Father sent the Son in John chapter 17. Perfected in unity, and it has to be a visible unity or the world can't see it. And when the world looks and sees the Catholic Church, but then it sees all these deformation churches, all of the Protestant churches and sects and factions, the world says, you know, guys, you come and tell us you have the truth, but why you can't even agree among yourselves what the truth is. Why don't you go get your own house in order, then come back and maybe we'll listen to you. Mahatma Gandhi said that if all Christians were united, India would fall at the feet of Jesus Christ in 24 hours. Goodness but we're me. Not, we're divided. How I came to understand it and how I usually approach it with other people is a historical approach. In other words, you know, don't get your Bible out and we'll debate book, chapter, and verse, because we're all going to have our favorite verses that we're going to use to defend our position. Baptist, Lutheran, Anglican, Catholic, whatever. Let's go back and ask ourselves, how did the very first Christians believe? What did they believe? What did they practice? What did they teach? What unity did they have before there was ever even a New Testament put together? And when you go back and you read the writings of, say, Eusebius, who wrote the first church history in 325, and you read the writings of Clement of Rome and Ignatius of Antioch and Justin Martyr and Polycarp, one of the ones that really influenced me the most was Irenaeus of Lyon, who in the second century wrote and said that even though there are many languages, there's only one teaching. As far as you go in the known world, we all teach the same thing. We're all Catholic. Justin Martyr says we come from all different areas to one church. And they didn't say, well, let's see. Americans, by the way, we pick our churches like we pick our restaurants. Monday afternoon, my wife and I drive down Main Street and we see McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, and other Burger King, whatever. And I say to my wife, what do you feel like today? And she said, well, I feel like a hamburger. So, okay, bro, we pull in and we get a hamburger. Maybe tomorrow she'll feel like a pizza. Then on Sunday morning, we drive down Main Street and there's Baptist and Lutheran and Anglican and Presbyterian. And I say to my wife, what do you feel like today? And we pick our churches the same way we pick our restaurants. What do I feel like today? What do I think I should be able to do and not do? What kind of music do I like? Instead of asking the question, what did Jesus leave behind? What did he expect? Did he start a church? And if he started a church, where is it? Is it still here? And that's going back to their very first writings, and I call them the Apostolic Fathers. I made a movie about them all on location called The Apostolic Fathers Handing on the Faith. In that movie, I show that before there was ever a New Testament, the first century, while it was still being written, they all were unified. They all had the same teaching. They had the the same views we do on the Eucharist and on the papacy and on Mary and on the priesthood and on justification. And so when you go back and you ask yourself, what did those very first Christians believe? That is, I think, more powerful than going and saying, well, what does the Bible say? Because we all have our own interpretations of the Bible, because you could twist it like a rubber nose any way you want. But you can't deny that the early church in the first centuries was a united church under the papacy and with bishops, priests, and deacons. And that is what it was. And that's how it got handed on, not by a book, but by the apostolic succession and the apostolic tradition.
It is extraordinary how the Protestant churches and Protestant Christians, bless them, have a form of Alzheimer's, a complete amnesia, really, from the Acts of the Apostles to 1519. When you ask them about the apostolic or the sub-apostolic fathers, they haven't read them. They really don't know. They have no idea, as you quite rightly say, that all the things that we do, including intercession for the saints and Our Lady, were there in the first three centuries and fourth centuries. It's partly ignorance. It's partly, I mean, one of the things I've become much more aware of here, too, is a kind of national propaganda narrative, which makes the national church, Anglicanism, right in all good and sensible things, and Catholicism the religion of left-footers, would-be traitors, the disputable citizens, and others. So in our country, unlike you, where in America it's a matter of freedom of choice, here we're battling against a degree of fake news that's been around for 400 or 500 years. I was astonished when I discovered that Cromwell had written up all the bad reports about the monasteries long before he sent the inspectors in, because the deal was done. They were not going to be examined as people thought and found wanting. They were going to be stitched up from the very beginning. One of the things I'd like to ask you about is how we manage theologically, pastorally, prophetically, with this great hemorrhaging in South America. In Europe and America, we're in the middle of these culture wars, which we're losing because we've been faithless to the Christian tradition that's been handed on to us by our fathers. In Asia, there's an extraordinary outpouring of Christianity, as both in Russia and China. In South America, there's this embarrassment that after the complete failure and red herring of liberation theology, so many good Catholics are now running after the Pentecostals. If you were Cardinal of South America, what would you say to the church in terms of how to deal with this spiritual hunger that's taking people in a direction that is ultimately going to be schismatic and unhelpful?
We only exacerbated the problem with that Amazonian synod. We only made it worse.
Sure.
I think like in the United States and in Europe, most of the people leaving the Catholic Church are doing so for secular reasons. Many of them are becoming secularized and materialists and denying the supernatural and wanting to do sexually, especially what they want to do, and don't want anybody to tell them what to do. So we're leaving the church for secularization, whereas in South America, many of them are leaving the church for the same reason, but they're going to these, and it's the same in the Philippines. I've been there 6 times. And I see many, many of them leaving also for these cults and sects, many of them coming from America, unfortunately. The problem is that the institutional Catholic Church is exactly that. It's institutional. The Pentecostal Church is not institutional. It's an event. It comes across as a supernatural reality. Even when in my days, when I saw that a little bit, we were going to a Baptist church, it was very institutionalized. And then we found this little cult called Salem Christian Fellowship, where they were casting out demons. And my goodness, I said to my dad and mom, I said, you know, we're going to this church. We just sing hymns and listen to a preacher, but I've never seen a miracle. I've never heard of a demon come out of anybody. And over here, look at this thing over here. They're talking in tongues and they're casting demons out. It sounds just like the book of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. And so I went there because I saw the reality, spiritual reality happening there. And people with a desire to know God were going there. And the spiritual world was real. In fact, it was predominant even over the secular culture. It was what was real. Now, I think in the Catholic Church in South America, it's the same kind of a dynamics, because you have there, the Catholic Church is institutionally, you go to Mass, you bow and pray to a statue of Mary, you know, you have to give your money. And then all of a sudden down the street, while you're at Mass, you hear the singing and these loud sounds coming and you go, look what it is. And it's like, the day of Pentecost has arrived. Well, who's not going to run over for that? Who's not going to say, this is real Christianity? This is the New Testament coming alive right in front of our eyes. I don't know how to counteract that. If I was a cardinal, I would start setting up, like back in the days of Billy Graham, where you had big rallies and crusades, and invite people in, invite Catholic evangelists to come in, and invite Catholic apologists to come in and have debates, have a big debate with these Protestant guys, and invite thousands of people and bring in good bands and good music and show that we Catholics are every bit as alive and lively as these folks are, but we've got the truth behind us, and let's debate it. Let's debate it out in public in a fun forum. This is what I would do. You can't just sit back. And by the way, when we use the phrase that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church, that doesn't mean that it won't prevail in a certain geographical area in a certain space of time. For example, in Turkey of today, that geographical area was the headquarters, the capital of the Byzantine Christian Empire, 100% Catholic.
Yeah.
And I looked out my window there when I was filming a couple of years ago, 17th story on the Hilton, and I counted 17 minarets of mosques. And I said to my wife, do you realize if you were here in the 6th century, you would have counted 17 church steeples and domes? Gates of hell have prevailed against Turkey. That is now 99.9% Muslim. Don't tell me the gates of hell haven't prevailed against that area of the world and in that geographical space and time. So we cannot just sit back and say, oh, in America, the gates of hell can't prevail against us. Oh, yes, it can. But I think what Jesus meant by that is that overall, in the end, there will always be the church. It'll never prevail against the church, although we're going to lose battles in certain places, but we're not going to lose the war in the end.
That's very interesting. So thank you, first of all, for giving some kind of clarity to the fact that one of the reasons we're losing in Europe and America is because of the issue of supernaturalism, and that people have adopted secularized criteria for trying to distinguish between what matters and doesn't matter. I'm sure that's absolutely right. One of the things I was very excited about was discovering the Eucharistic miracle of Buenos Aires, and discovering that a laboratory had done some scientific tests and discovered, there were aspects of living humanity in the Eucharistic bread. And I'm so surprised that other people are not blown away by this, because for the whole of my theological life, I've been debating in my head with Aquinas about transubstantiation, and all the kind of the intellectual default position is to go towards Luther and Zwingli so that you're not mistaken or made a fool of. But to discover that in our generation we have bleeding hosts which quite clearly have human tissue in them, I don't understand why the Catholic Church is not making more of this and saying, guys, you see all those Eucharistic hymns Aquinas wrote, they're all true. And you've made a terrible category error. Come home to Rome. But again, they don't. And it's very helpful, too, to notice that in South America, it's not supernaturalism. It's the incompetence of the Church. And that's the next thing I want to ask you about. One of the things I find myself doing is debating this appalling issue of synodality, which Cardinal Pell quite rightly said is going to turn things into a nightmare. It does seem to me that there could have been a synodal process that would have been of some value, and that would have been to ask what it takes to bring Catholic communities into a deeper life. The fact that the deformation split the church doesn't mean it got everything wrong. There are some very important things that have nurtured Christian communities: reading the Bible together, praying together, pastoral care, exploring the gifts of the Holy Spirit. All these things are part of the early church, quite as much as they're part of the deformation churches. One of the things that seems to happen in Catholicism, it too needs a rediscovery of aspects of the sub-apostolic apostolic church. The Protestants do have, even if they've got the doctrine wrong and the theology of the church wrong and the theology of the Mass and Our Lady wrong, they do at least have some dynamics of ecclesial community right.
They do. They have the best ice cream socials that you're going to find anywhere. They understand that if you mix the church service with social life and you have ice cream after the Mass, that's what we call them in the Baptist churches, ice cream socials and these great buffets, the potluck dinners, we call them. But even some of the big mega churches in America you would think, well, they're going to be impersonal because they have thousands of people going. But you know what they emphasize is the small group dynamic.
Right.
The Bible study, the how to parent. They got hundreds, some of these, they have hundreds of different classes you can join. And they foster a big church that my wife and I went to when we, a long time ago, I remember the pastor would come and introduce himself to every single visitor that ever came to that church. He would come and spend an hour or two, and he memorized their names before he came. And they would emphasize all of these small groups. You had to be a part of small groups because that's where the real personal thing comes about. We and as Catholics have really failed. The Mass is important. Obviously, it's the source and summit of our faith. But if you just go to Mass in the morning on Sunday, you are not doing what a Catholic's supposed to do. For example, just say, Gavin, I wake up and I decide, tell my family, well, from now on, I'm really busy. I've got a lot of things to do, but I will meet with you every Sunday morning for breakfast. Kind of a family is that? What kind of a relationship? Does everybody want to be like dad? Is there going to be a family dynamic that passes the faith on to the next generation? Heavens no. And I really am sad, by the way, in many ways, the Catholic Church has not jumped into doing small groups and Bible studies and emphasizing. Now, I do go to a parish. It's our home parish. I don't get there very often because of our travels, but it's called Christ the King in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they are a charismatic parish. And they have so many Bible studies and conferences and young people groups and mothers groups that 5 years ago, they had 23 men in the seminary from this one parish of 600 families.
Wow.
Because they take the spiritual life real. They take small groups and this has become their life. They have 24-hour day adoration that you can go in with the Blessed Sacrament. And this church is just alive. My grandkids go there, and my grandkids are the holiest young men. I'll give you an example. My grandson Damien just turned 18. They think he might be losing his eyesight. And he said, "That's okay, Papa." He said, "If I lose my eyesight, it'll just give me a whole lot more focus on prayer."
Wow.
This is an 18-year-old boy. We should have parishes now that foster the spiritual life, foster young people getting together, not just to talk about the latest rock group band, but that really believe that God is out there. He's really here. I think we failed that. And in the South America, because we have failed in those things, it's become just a cultural practice that we do. All of a sudden, it's not our life anymore. If we treated the Catholic faith like we treat our favorite football team, my goodness, just think about how enthusiastic we'd all be.
I think that's right. There's always a sense that somehow human beings get off balance. And one of the more useful paradigms that I find myself turning back to is that of transcendence and immanence. And now this fails partly because although transcendence is about awe and majesty and glory, the Father at the very pinnacle of creation, there is, of course, an immediate immanence built into the Mass as we take Jesus deep into our bodies. But where immanence fails is at the level of the community. So it's almost like, I suppose, we have transcendence at one level in the Mass and in Catholic worship and a profound immanence in Eucharistic adoration and practice. But there's a sociological level where it just doesn't happen. You know, that is indeed where the Protestants have picked it up and do well. And it just strikes me that if there was going to be a synodal process, one of the things we should be doing is asking where we have lost our balance in terms of the way in which we do church in order to mend those areas where the church is failing. As you quite rightly say, in South America, is the need for community and for belonging and for participation.
Exactly. Even Protestants don't have it all together. I mean, we say Protestants, but I'm convinced that 9 out of 10 Protestants don't have a clue either. They don't have a spiritual life. They don't live or practice anything other than just the secular world does too. You know, I actually, in the Catholic Church, I question how bad we really are, because I would say that there's 5, maybe 10% of people that go to daily Mass and really pray every day and they make a life of this. But it's no more than that in Protestant churches too, if you take statistics absolutely. Of all of Protestantism. You're not going to get more than 5 or 10% of people who really go to church and they really pray and read the Bible and witness and share it with other people. There's a kind of an equality going on there. But I think in South America, where you brought it up, it's this Pentecostal emotionalism and people respond to that. Usually it takes an hour to get it going. You know, you've got the music and you've got the singing. And you get moving, and about an hour later, everybody's really into it. Now, on the day of Pentecost, it didn't take an hour of music to get everybody full of the Spirit. The Holy Spirit doesn't need that. But I do think that that element, though, really people respond to it in South America and other parts of the world. I do think that guys like you, though, and guys like me, coming into the Catholic Church, we're enthusiastic. And I don't care if people think I'm a little off balance. That's fine. I love what I have discovered, and I'm not going to be shy about sharing it and being excited about it. And I know the lines you don't cross and the balance you have to keep. But at the same time, I know that someday I'm going to be judged by how I shared the faith with other people. And I don't want anybody in heaven to say, "You, damn you, Steve Ray, because you never told me." You know, I want my whole life to, I wear this every day, Gavin, because it's a beautiful San Damiano cross. And every day somebody asks me, and so that's beautiful. And I get a chance to talk about the Lord. That's why I wear this thing. Well, that's wonderful. And if there's more of us like this, we're going to have an impact.
Enthusiasm and theos, who can complain about a God being within it to a greater intensity? You're quite right about seminary. I went to a very evangelical seminary, and everyone talked about prayer all the time. We patted ourselves on the backs for our intimate relationship with Jesus and our reading of the Bible. We had a quiet time built in of about nearly an hour every morning. And from time to time, I would break the rules and I would go and knock on someone's door because although we should have been praying, there was something urgent. Every time I knocked on the door and went in, they were reading the newspaper. They were not praying at all. And then at that point, I began to realize that my own difficulties in prayer were not my own, were not just mine. I knew I had difficulties in prayer. I just thought it was me because I was such an incompetent Christian and such a sinner. It took me a while to discover the whole evangelical community pretended about prayer. And that was, again, one of the most wonderful things about the rosary was suddenly to begin to be able to do prayer as opposed to not do prayer. And I think you're right. I think there's a great charade at the heart of evangelical Protestantism, which it hurts one to say, except that one was part of it, which is not there at the heart of Catholicism. When you see the Mass exposed for adoration and the rosary there to be done, it is impossible not to pray.
And communally.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because I remember when we used to get together as a group of Protestants to pray, it was very uncomfortable because we didn't have any guidance. And somebody would lead out, and if you didn't have the word "just" over here anyway, you couldn't pray. "Lord, we are just here to just ask you that you would just bless us." And then the next guy would feel obligated to pray. And I love the Catholic Church because it has these prayers which are so much more intelligent than the prayers that we used to come up with. I used to say that as a Protestant, we were in a very big lake, a big pond, but it was only 2 inches deep and you had to splash a lot to stay wet. Whereas when you, and everything had to come from, all the prayer and things had to come from the shallow puddle of my own existence. In the Catholic Church, you immerse yourself in this big ocean and it's all there already. You don't have to reinvent all these things. The beautiful prayers. Yes, I can pray spontaneously anytime I want, and that's we should. But we can also take advantage of, say, like the rosary. On our pilgrimages, we pray the rosary on the bus, and everybody's face lights up when I say, "Would you like to pray?" Because it's all being done together, and we're meditating on the gospel. I agree with you. It is, it's a very different world being a Catholic, and much more holistic, I think.
That's right. And we don't, you know, it's such a relief not to have to impress anybody with my spirituality, but instead pray the rosary. Thank God. Thank Our Lady too. Now, a very difficult area is this. I am so fed up with people when they see the latest news from the Vatican or the latest heresy from the church in Germany, looking at me and saying, "Ha, ha, ha, Gavin, you jumped from the frying pan to the fire." And my answer is, I always knew I would be going from the frying pan to the fire. I always knew the civil culture wars are as deep in Rome as anywhere else. But the difference is you've lost them or you're losing them in Protestantism. And we're not going to lose them in Catholicism because everything depends upon winning. That's where the fight is. It's like the kind of last battle in the Narnia books or the final fight after Mordor in Lord of the Rings. This is the big one. But it's made very much more difficult by some of the things that our Holy Father says in Rome. And although no doubt there are some very worthwhile aspects to Francis's papacy, he's very skillful with the media, nonetheless, the atmosphere of ambiguity that has slowly, painfully accumulated is very difficult for the convert coming in, because it has been so demoralizing for so many people. And I wished I'd converted under JP too.
I did.
Blessed are you amongst converts. So I know you've done a YouTube video, and I hope we'll put the YouTube video link up. But meanwhile, can you give some tips on how a faithful Catholic surfs the waves of ambiguity and dissonance under this present papacy? May the Lord bless Pope Francis and keep him.
Yes. The talk I gave was to the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre in six states here. There was 10 bishops there, Scott Hahn, Matthew Bunsen from EWTN. The lieutenant of the Equestrian Order, there was hundreds of people there in their robes, because this is a order of knights from the Crusades time. And I've been a member for over 22 years. So when I gave the talk, I reminded that I've been a member of this order longer than any of you have. I would be willing to bet that. And I've written two books on the papacy and published by Ignatius Press. So don't tell me I don't know what I'm talking about here today. And the title of my, I thought he was going to ask me to speak about the Holy Land. I've been there 200 times. So this is an equestrian order. They defend the Holy Land. So he says, no, no. He says, your topic is, how does a John Paul II Catholic survive in a Pope Francis world? I says, you got to be kidding me. You want me to talk about that in front of 10 bishops and 100 or so? I said, okay, I'll do it. And I did it. And that's the video that you're going to post on there. And my whole theme was on that video, and this is, I'm going to say two areas of how I deal with the current papacy and Vatican is, one is what I do think and do, and one is what I don't do anymore. I'll start out with what I do. In that talk, I explained that no pope is infallible. And what I mean by that is when he's on an airplane being interviewed, he's not infallible. He cannot predict the weather tomorrow, nor can he predict the football scores. He is not infallible in that sense. He's not even impeccable. He is a sinner like the rest of us. He's only infallible under very strict conditions, and those strict conditions are carefully defined, and this pope has never yet ever used those conditions to speak infallibly. We give deference to the Holy Father, but the second point is that no pope is beyond criticism. And some people think if you criticize the Pope, you're not Catholic anymore, you're going to go to hell. That is not the case. Even the Catechism says that we lay people have the right and even the duty to speak out when we think things are being done wrong by our uppers. And it says in Galatians chapter 2:11, Paul, who is not the Pope, addresses Peter, who was the Pope, and he even refers to him as Cephas, which means the rock. I went up to see the rock, but I confronted him to his face because he stood condemned. Now, this is Paul, who's not the Pope, speaking to Cephas, who is, and he condemns him to his face because he was not teaching wrong, he was practicing wrong. So right from Scripture, we see that we can. No pope is beyond criticism. And then you go to Aquinas and to Augustine, and they use that passage to explicate that even further. And even Pope Francis says that I'm always open to criticism, and it's a good thing. So, okay, good. We'll take you up on that.
Indeed, so, he does. Yeah, that's right.
So when my talk, then, I wanted to emphasize what infallibility really is and isn't, and that no pope is beyond criticism. And I came up there, Gavin, it was kind of fun. I came up there with a yellow box, and I had red crosses all over it. And on it, it says on there, the unchangeable and immutable word of God. And I carried that box up onto the stage, and I set it on the podium. And I didn't talk about it until the end of my, I know everybody's saying, what is that box? What does this guy bring that box up for? I said, this is the deposit of faith. The apostles are the last ones that had the public revelation. They deposited that into this box, which is considered the deposit of faith. And every bishop has to promise to pass that on to the next bishop without altering it, without changing it. And I said, but I get the feeling lately that some people in the Vatican are opening that box and they're putting their dirty hands in there and messing around with that deposit of faith. And it's not their deposit of faith. It's my deposit of faith. And I get irritated and very angry when someone starts messing with my deposit of faith. And they had to promise they would not alter it or change it. They would protect it and pass it on. And I don't want anybody's dirty hands in that box. That's how I ended my talk. And then I said, our obligation as Catholics today is not to change the Pope or to change Rome, because I can't do that anyway. I have no influence in Rome. Although I have to tell you that Rome called and tried to get my talk canceled.
No.
Three times. They heard that I was giving a talk, and I got there was three calls from Rome to cancel my talk. Thanks be to God, they stuck to their guns and didn't cancel it. But I ended up by saying, we're on the deck of a ship. The ship is the Catholic Church. We're on our way across the ocean to the celestial city. My job, even if the captain is teaching wrong and directing the boat wrong and it's starting to rock, my job isn't to go down and tell the Pope what to do. My job is to stay on deck and tell people, folks, there's no more sipping martinis anymore. It's all hands on deck. We need to teach our fellow Catholics what the truth is. We need to teach our young people what the morals really are about contraception and abortion and all of these issues. We need to teach them that they know the doctrine of the faith for 2,000 years and keep them on the deck. And let's hold on to the deck until the new Pope comes along and hope that he's a better one than this one is.
That's very helpful. And I think a lot of people will resonate with that. It gives us something brave and determined to do. One of the first things that I did on becoming a Catholic was to read a book on the worst popes. And then I thought, nothing can surprise me. Nothing can take me aback.
No.
There was a wonderful story. I've told this before, and I hope you forgive me, but it seems to me to be appropriate again, and there's no end of telling it. We had a television program that the BBC put out on the Borgias. And as you can imagine, they went to town on the incest and the sex and the immorality and the greed and the power and corruption. And they made a big thing of it. And so many people in the 1980s in Great Britain said, wow, look at that stinky Catholic church. So immoral. How can anyone believe anything that comes out of that institution? And there's an old lady who at that particular time was received into the church. And she somehow made the headlines. Because people said to her, look, we've all just watched the Borgias. No one can believe in the Catholic Church anymore. How is it possible that you, an old lady with some sense of perspective, at this particular cultural juncture, how can you become a Roman Catholic? And she said, well, I've been looking at the life of Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and I've been tremendously impressed. And she said, it seems to me that if there was no God and the Catholic Church was bunk, then it would be absolutely impossible for an institution to survive the level of decadence and degradation that it had sunk to in the 16th century. But if that same institution and that same God can produce Mother Teresa with this outstanding, beautiful, compassionate holiness, radiance of faith and love, only a God can explain that. And any church that does that has to be the true church. And so I'm becoming a Catholic. And I thought that level of confidence and stamina and determination, as you say, no more sipping martinis, all hands on deck. That's very good.
Right. There's a quote in a book called Staying with the Church, and I love this quote. The church's structures, offices, and ruling authorities are necessary to keep Christ present in the world. But his presence transcends their limitations, including the moral failures of his own vicars. So this is how he keeps the visible church in the world. You need a CEO. You need the structure. But his abilities transcend that. And I remember when I came into the church, one of the things I said to my wife is, I defy anyone to show me a church that produces Mother Teresa's and John Paul II and Teresa of Lisieux and St. John of the Cross. Show me a church that produces those kind of saints. They don't. Only the Catholic Church does.
Absolutely. That's very good. We're looking to the future. Cardinal Pell has just died. I was hugely impressed with him. He was an inspiration for me in all kinds of ways. And it looks as though one of the things he did before he died was to write an anonymous briefing note to the cardinals to help them prepare for the next conclave. And as I read it, I thought, well, whoever Demos is, I don't care who Demos is, they're telling the truth. Well, it was very encouraging to know that it was Pell himself. What do you make of his advice to the cardinals as everyone, because, you know, our blessed Holy Father in Rome is elderly, and at some point he'll be carried off to meet our Lord in the joy that awaits him, and the cardinals will have to choose another successor to St. Peter. What do you make of this memo that Cardinal Pell left behind, and what is your intuitive judgment on how the cardinals might see the needs for a future pope?
He actually left two things behind, if I recall right. He wrote the Demos one, but he also wrote another criticism right before he died, and thank God he did. But what I understand is that the Pope is not well liked in the Vatican, and I'm no inside Vatican watcher, but I do read some good folks that I think are and who are veterans at it, and he's not well liked. He comes across as a bully, and people don't like bullies, and he has not brought the cardinals together in years, when there's no cardinal conclave, so the cardinals don't know each other. And I don't think that they have a loyalty to this pope, because he hasn't ingratiated himself or it been a big brother to them, so to speak. And so when that goes around to telling the cardinals, and I've heard that they are reading it, it's passing around among the cardinals, what the next pope should do, my hope and my prayer and my suspicion is that there may be a swing of the pendulum back from, I don't think there'll be another Jesuit elected. I'd be willing to bet money on that. But I bet that the swing of the pendulum will come back more. I think there's a lot of us, and the cardinals included, who miss John Paul II, and maybe even Benedict, though he was older and more frail. But I think there's a lot of them that miss John Paul II and the clarity and the personality and the fraternity and all of the things that John Paul had that this pope doesn't have. My hope is that Cardinal Pell's documents will help in that swing in the other direction. And I was going to say, too, when I said about thinking about the papacy, what I do, I was going to say what I don't do. I used to spend a lot of my day reading about American politics and about the Vatican. And I found my blood pressure kept going up and my life was perturbed. And I don't have the joy. And I can't do anything about it anyway. I can read all I want about the Vatican now and the Pope. And I can read all about the President of the United States, and our government is as screwed up, I think, as the Vatican is right now. And if I spend my time reading about that and fretting over it, I'm going to lose all my joy, and nobody's going to want to be around me. So what I've done is I realized, Gavin, that for up until 100 years ago, you and I had no idea what the Pope was thinking or doing, and very little idea of what the Queen or the King or the President was doing. We lived in our communities. We went to our Catholic parishes. We helped people. We fed the poor. We went and worshiped, and we lived in our Catholic communities, and we loved our Catholic communities. All of a sudden now we're bombarded by internet and news, and it's disrupting our serenity. And I've decided pretty much I'm not going to waste my time anymore reading everything about the Vatican and the Pope, you know, our president. I'm going to spend more time just in my local community with my family and loving the Lord and doing what I can to teach people and to help them stay faithful Catholics and understand what the truth is. Once in a while, I'll pay attention to it. Like when Cardinal Pell dies and I read these documents, I say, yes, yes, I love it. I'm glad he wrote this thing. But in general, I'm becoming more monkish, I guess, towards these things.
Steve Ray, thank you for everything you've written. Thank you for all the public work that you offer to bless the church. Thank you for encouraging us. Thank you for telling the truth. Thank you for your joy, and thank you for joining us on the podcast today. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Bless you.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Gavin. I hope we can do it again sometime. And when I'm in England next time, I'm going to look you up.
That would be a great joy. Thank you. I look forward to it.